Hi, Mets fans. Welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And Chris, we're recording this on Wednesday, September 8th. We just watched Edwin Diaz and Luis Rojas give away a game to the Marlins, of all people. And we're at a place now where the Mets, while still somewhat close in the division, are not in first place and have not been in first place for a while. And it's starting to look like maybe they will never be in first place again. It is too early to say any of that, I'm aware. We don't know how the rest of the season is going to go, but if you were a gambling man, would you place a bet on the Mets either regaining first place at any point this season or of finishing the season in first place?
I would not, and I realize this is pretty pessimistic coming from me, but I just don't see it. It's funny, last week we didn't really talk too much about the baseball the Mets were playing because, one, they hadn't been that far removed from the really bad stretch. It turned out we recorded as they were in the midst of building a nice winning streak and getting themselves back into things in the division. But a game like tonight, and Sandy Alcantara was outstanding, and that yes. happens to you sometimes. But they survived that, and then they lost.
Yes, and they lost pretty specifically because Luis Rojas did not pitch around the only really hot hitter in the lineup for the Marlins tonight. And that sort of mistake, I mean, it really chaps my ass when that happens. It just feels like a very avoidable mistake for the Mets to make. You know, look, there's every chance that who was coming up after? It was Diaz, I think, was coming up after him. Luis Diaz, perhaps? Is that his name? Sounds wrong.
Isan?
No, it wasn't Isan Diaz. It was the other Diaz. Lewin. Sorry, Lewin Diaz.
Oh, yes. Okay. Admittedly, I could not name the entire Marlins roster right now.
Oh, of course not. No, I get that. but the so Lewin Diaz is ice cold, but there's every chance that he could have gotten a hit, and it would have made walking Brian De La Cruz irrelevant. But to me, you have to take that chance in the ninth, in extra innings, especially with the free runner on third base. You have to go after the hitter who's not going to burn you, and yet that's exactly what Rojas did. And I mean, everybody from the broadcasters to seemingly the fans were all expecting it to be of course they're gonna walk him now. They're gonna pitch to Davis to. I keep wanting to say Lewin Davis because of inside Lewin Davis. Lewin Diaz. They're of course gonna pitch to Diaz, but that didn't happen, and obviously it didn't go well for the Mets. And just on a personal note, I hate it. And the Mets. This has been going on with the Mets for a while now. When they point to the sky whenever there's a ball hit in the air, as if it's a pop up. And then the ball went 400 fucking feet and bounced off the center field wall. That just drives me absolutely bonkers. But, you know, whatever. It's one game, but Diaz has not been great lately. His last two appearances before this were not good. He blew a save against the Nationals over the weekend. And then he, I guess, did they win? The top of the next is basically he pitched in two games, pitched poorly in both games, gave up two earned runs in each game, but only suffered the loss in one of those games. Now, obviously, relief pitchers are volatile. Diaz was still throwing fire tonight, and in some instances, are you at all worried about Edwin Diaz and his stuff right now, or do you think this is just, you know, the bad luck that happens to pitchers.
Yeah, I think it's just that. The last couple appearances before this one tonight were sort of legitimately bad, but the free runner thing, it's hard to get on any reliever who
right.
has to start an inning under those circumstances. And in this case, with the Mets having not scored, only allows that free runner to score. Obviously, that free runner scored on a very well hit ball, but I don't know. It's not as significant of a bad outing when that's what happens. So
right, no, I agree with that.
And I did not get to watch all of the last couple of appearances before this one, but that being said, I'd still be inclined to say that okay, this is just one of those things, and he's going to be fine. And the rest of the way, whatever chances the Mets do have of getting back into it, it's not going to be like they have somebody who's better.
Right.
To fill that role.
Right. Speaking of someone better, to me, this loss falls squarely on Luis Rojas, who I think with every passing minute becomes more and more clear that he will not be managing the Mets next season. Do you have any doubt that Rojas is gone after this season?
Maybe just a little, but that's only because I'm not entirely convinced that there will be an overhaul. Even though the events of the past 8 months or so should probably indicate that there should be.
Fair enough, yeah.
But I'm not entirely convinced that that will happen. So if some of the existing structure stays in place, I could see them keeping Rojas as manager. I am sure if they don't, it'll kind of go the same route of recent past managers like Terry Collins, who become special assistants or something else, you know, within the organization, assuming they want to take that role. And look, Luis Rojas is a great backstory, you know, from coming into the organization and working fairly low level jobs and you know, doing tasks early on that, you know, you don't do anywhere when you're manager of the major league team. and that's great. But at the same time, you need somebody who's in that dugout who is running the team in a way that optimizes the opportunity to win. And I don't know. Just don't see it. And it was similar too when before we knew about his significant harassment issues, when Mickey Callaway was hired, and early on, you watch and you're like, okay, here's a managerial tendency that maybe I don't like. And then a month later it happens again. And I think, and maybe I'm wrong with this, but I think going through a new manager twice in a short span of time and having the experience feels so similar, where it's like, okay, here's that thing that we noticed that we don't like, and then it happens the second time, it happens the third time. That thing is probably never going to change.
Right.
Not exactly groundbreaking, material here to say that Major League Baseball managers might be the most resistant to change people on the planet.
Right.
But I think what you see is what you get. And I don't know. There's just not a whole lot of adaptation there. And look, we know over the years, especially the most recent decade, that the manager's role has been reduced.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that doesn't mean you shouldn't try to improve it.
See, the reason I think that he is gone is because... So when the Cohen-Alderson group took over, they did not necessarily say Rojas was going to be their manager. They sort of waffled on it, and they said, you know, we're going to sort of see how things go. And they said something along the lines of, like, well, we have no reason to believe he's not going to be our manager. But clearly they were testing the waters to see if there was somebody else out there who they had their eye on who would be interested in the job. And nobody was. And so that's what happened. And you got Rojas as manager. So I think that because they wouldn't commit to him last season and they wanted to see what else is out there, now they've got to watch him for a season and they've seen up close his not great tendencies. And so I just think because of that, you're going to see him gone. Because if they were sold on him beforehand, they would have given him a more vote of confidence last offseason. And the fact that he's made so many poor decisions this season, the fact that he seemingly does not have a good grasp on the clubhouse based on he didn't know what the thumbs down thing meant until the press knew what the thumbs down thing meant. It just seems like he's not great in the clubhouse. He's not great on the field. He wasn't their first choice. They're going to clean house. And now that Cohen's money is firmly ensconced in this team, if they wanted to make a splash and bring a big name in, I'm not saying that's the right move, but if they wanted to do that, they could do that pretty easily now.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point about how they approach things coming into this season. So, yeah, it's just kind of wild to think that another new manager, another new general manager are likely on the horizon. And we've seen that multiple times recently, and it has not been a successful endeavor in making those decisions, to say the least. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't have like a wish list kind of going for either of those roles. I think there are pros and cons. I know some names have been thrown out there, whether it's president of baseball operations that they are seeking to fill. And that was something that was being talked about before Zach Scott got the DUI arrest. So, you know, basically the whole baseball side of things, anybody who you would, as a fan or reporter, hear from publicly about what's going on the field, it's pretty likely, or at least very possible, that all of those people will be different people next year.
Yeah, I think that makes the most...
It's a lot of turnover.
It is a lot of turnover, but I also wonder if... Like, if you're going to do turnover, isn't this the year to do it? Like, aren't there so many excuses right now that you can put out there that almost nobody can argue with? Like, if you're going to shit-can Alderson, which I don't think he's going to do, but if you do, if you're Cohen, you could say, look, he hired Jared Porter, he didn't do his due diligence. He hired Zach Scott, there was an issue there. The team was in first place, and at the trade deadline, they did not make enough, did not make wise moves, and so therefore, we didn't make the playoffs. Like, there's so many things you can point to that are very, very clear for almost every position in the organization. And so if you're going, like, this is different to me. If the Mets had made the playoffs and had gotten eliminated in a hard-fought game, I don't think you could fire Rojas. If Zach Scott had not gotten a DUI and they acquired three great relievers at the deadline and they held on, even if you don't love Zach Scott, you're not getting rid of him for next season. everything that could have gone wrong on and off the field has gone wrong for this team this year. And so I don't think – I think if there's the desire there to clean house, I don't know if you will ever get a cleaner time to do that than right now.
Well, yeah. And I do think it's something that's been mentioned on the site and certainly on either this podcast or definitely on a pod of their own. But – Sandy Alderson was around to hire Mickey Callaway too. And right. Obviously that didn't factor into bringing Alderson back, but you look at this pattern where we wound up learning this year that the Callaway's worst actions were the worst kept secret in baseball. And people joked about it all the time.
Dick pick Mick.
Right. That hire was made with, there's no way that wasn't known. And not that you should ever take somebody who's known to be that type of person and put them into a spot like that. That's so important to your entire organization, but you took that on for Mickey Callaway. Who wound up right. being like not good at the job at all. So it's, you know, that there was a willingness to ignore what was widely known or at least widely speculated upon. But everything that was written this year made it sound like it was pretty clearly known.
Yes.
So ignoring that and then still hiring a guy who wasn't good at the job anyway. You know, so obviously, if Cohen were to decide to phase Alderson out, because I don't think it would be an outright, oh, I fired him kind of thing. You know, I think it would be more of a mutual parting of ways or whatever. I don't know if he could necessarily stand on that because he hired him after all that happened.
Right.
Anyway, but you do look at it, and that is still another strike against him with the hiring process.
Yes. I think what will happen – I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish your thought, and then I'll say what I was going to say.
Yeah, no. It's I understand why Cohen probably thought it was advantageous to finalize the sale of the team and bring somebody in with a ton of experience. And like you said a few minutes ago, I would still bet that he will be in the team president role next year. It's just maybe he'll be pretty hands-off on the baseball side.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. I think you'll see him be the team president, but there'll be a president of baseball operations. And right. So he will just be a relatively impactful on the baseball side guy, but to help to maybe, you know, reorganize the team in other ways. Of course, I mean, I don't think it's breaking news to say that many of us don't want Alderson anywhere near this team at all anymore. And that I was about as staunch an Alderson supporter as there was during his first tenure. I thought the way that he left the team was bullshit. I thought that he was somebody who did a really great job with limited resources. All of that I will stand behind for the first time through. But again, we didn't know about Mickey Callaway and all that the first time through. So I just think that there's this thing that happens to people, and I'm sure it'll happen to me one day if it hasn't already, where you're out of doing good. Like, I think you can look at certain musicians, certain politicians, whoever, where at a certain point their decision-making just goes haywire, and they do not necessarily represent the good that they once represented. And I feel like Alderson has just... time has passed him by in a very short time frame, and that's a bummer for him, but that doesn't change the fact that I think time has passed him by. Well,
yeah,
I guess
I think that's fair. I mean, it's just somebody who I don't think, you know, if asked about all of the issues, I think he would be one to say that he was firmly against the things that Scott Porter Callaway did.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, saying that when it's something has already happened is different from doing the work to avoid getting into that situation in the first place.
People often ask me if prosecuting the mob is like the movies. Well, there is violence.
He cracks his guys over the head and it popped just like a melon popped.
There are hits.
So it wasn't just permission to take him out, but permission to take out his own nephew.
But after taking down over 100 mobsters, I can tell you this. The real thing is much more interesting. I'm Eli Honig, former mob prosecutor and host of the new podcast, Up Against the Mob. Up Against the Mob lifts the veil on the world's most secretive criminal organization, La Cosa Nostra. We'll talk to prosecutors, former mobsters, and undercover agents. And unlike Hollywood, all these stories are true. New episodes drop every Wednesday starting September 8th. Listen and follow Up Against the Mob on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
So I guess my final question I wanted to ask you tonight is on the baseball side of things. Is there a obviously it's nice to see Conforto hitting a little bit. Do you think there's any change in the Mets strategy for Conforto with him putting it together a little bit this September, or has this season been so slow that you I guess just slow and unproductive from him that you don't think that do you think he's going to need a pillow contract or something of the like for next year? Do you see any way that he still goes out and gets the big Boris contract because of a good September?
No. No, I don't. Could be wrong, could be proven wrong on it, but I think the QO is like kind of the ceiling, at least from a potential future with the Mets. And I don't know. Coming off this kind of season, I'm not sure any other team would necessarily blow him away. It feels like if the QO is something that is extended to him and then isn't totally annihilated in the new CBA, given the timing of things, I don't know that it necessarily could be, because that offer would have to be made before this one expires.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I it seems like offering him that and him accepting it is probably the best thing that could happen
for both of them. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, it's possible that he's just toast. Stranger things have happened. I would think that he's not. He's still 28 years old. He's gotten himself up to this point, to, you know, being slightly above league average as a hitter this year. And that's a significant improvement, but it also kind of fits in nicely when you go to look at his stats on a year by year basis. And, when a guy is typically above 100 in OPS plus or WRC plus, whichever one you prefer, it's nice when you go down that list. And he had 1 year that he was just below with a 97. But overall, you know, somebody who's always better than a league average hitter. So in that sense, it's like, okay, you know, that sort of salvage things and makes it look more like somewhat of a down year instead of a total disaster.
Right.
But I don't think that's enough to get other teams to bite, to the point that they'll give them something massive and significant. I do think there are teams out there that would offer him more than the Mets if the qualifying offer is declined. But yeah, it's just been weird. His season feels like a microcosm of the team in a way. I know they were in first place for a long time while he was struggling. So not that part, but the getting hot late in the season when things are just a little bit too late.
Yeah.
Part. That part feels like a very good representation of what the 2021 Mets are. So I don't know. Maybe they'll win 10 games in a row and Conforto will be their best hitter over that stretch. In any season recently going into it, it was always entirely possible he'd be their best hitter. And that could, if he does something drastic, I could see maybe a little bit of influence on that. But even when you look back and think of big contracts in Mets history, Carlos Beltran was coming off an unbelievable postseason run, but he had also been unbelievable consistently before that.
Right.
So yeah, that sustained excellence and then a super hot streak at the end to push things over the top to really capitalize. That's different from, you know, the way that this looks. So we'll see. I want Conforto to be a Met. I don't want to see him go elsewhere. I'd love to see him, you know, kind of get back to being his usual self and be part of a successful Mets team. It's wild that his rookie year was the year that they went to the World Series and was, you know, several years ago now.
Yes.
That feels very recent.
Yes, it does. Is there a guy that you think he lines up well with in terms of comps? I don't even care necessarily about stats. I'm not talking specifically like the you know, like who has the closest like WRC plus or Hall of Fame like Jaws score, whatever. But is there a guy that he feels like to you in Mets history? Like, is there a player that he's sort of, he's this era's blank player?
It's funny. So I don't have a perfect answer for that. Who does he feel like he is? Mm-hmm. But I do have an answer for who I hope, who I feel like I hope he's not.
Okay.
And it's Ryan Church.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But by no means. Michael Conforto has done much more in his career up to this point than Ryan Church had done when he arrived with the Mets. But I guess it's just sort of like generic looking white dude corner outfielder.
Sure.
Who went from, and in Church's case, there was, you know, a significant sort of marker with the concussion and, you know, and the aftermath of that. You know, that was a more significant thing. But I hope he's not that. I hope he's not the guy who went from productive major league hitter to not, and then that's it. But in terms of a comp of who he is, I don't know. Is it like a, I know that this isn't a quiz.
No, because he feels, I don't know who he feels like.
Man, Kevin McReynolds is 61. Jeez. you know, so McReynolds didn't start his career as a Met, but fairly similar run. Again, you know, we're talking about an outfielder who was like a well above average hitter, especially in his time with the Mets. Year in and year out, you know, this is a guy who was not maybe the best hitter in the league or anything, but well above league average and hitting similar numbers of home runs, similar, you know, similar slash lines, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I guess to try to answer that question, I don't know if that's the best answer there is, but Kevin McReynolds kind of feels like the most comparable Met.
I could see that. I was trying to think of a guy who had a really promising career for the, with the Mets and then kind of never lived up to it elsewhere. And I was kind of thinking of Howard Johnson.
Hmm.
Homegrown guy. Wasn't his rookie year 86?
Was it? I should probably know that off the top of my head.
It was around there. Let's see. No, I'm sorry. No, he didn't start his career as a Met. He started on the Tigers. I forgot that. His first year as a Met was 85. Right. Okay, I thought it was the year before. Year after, rather. But no, just Howard Johnson kind of felt like there was a guy who, for a couple of years there, Howard Johnson was going to be the next big thing for the Mets, and he had that incredible 30-30 season and, you know, was an all-star a couple of times. And then just sort of by the end of his Mets career, and he wasn't that old, just kind of fizzled out. You know, his last really good year was his age 30 season. You know, after that, he never really... He had 38 home runs in 1991 and then never hit more than 10 after that. And hopefully Conforto pulls the nose up a little bit, but sort of the late career feeling of Howard Johnson, I just kind of get from, I got from the early parts of Conforto's season this year.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have forgot he started on the Tigers. That's on me. That's bad. I should know better than that. Oh, well. Any other Mets-related ephemera to talk about before we move on to our music picks?
No. Just a quick note that the Mets coming out and saying that, oh, Jacob DeGrom's elbow had a sprain of the UCL, and it's totally fine. It's recovered now. I guess, what's the way of putting this? You have to be skeptical of any injury update from the Mets.
Yes.
The latter part, I am willing to entertain the possibility that's true. But Alderson got very defensive, I think, when it was brought up that they said nothing was wrong consistently for a while.
Right.
And we know, you know, that it's sort of just been in limbo. Nobody's really asked about it. Nobody's talked about it. But when the Mets went out to California during that awful stretch that they just had before playing the Marlins and Nationals, we knew DeGrom was seeing a doctor out there for, I don't know if it was second, third, whatever, you know, further opinion on what was going on. And there was no update. So if there was a sprain of the UCL on an MRI, they clearly had to know about that for longer. Yep. So then to just say like, oh yeah, that was an issue, but it's fine now. It's very understandable that people would say like, wait a second, you just spent 2.5 months saying that, or I guess 2 months saying that it was clean and, you know, there was no issue at all. So now it's, oh yeah, there was an issue, but it's totally recovered. Obviously I hope that DeGrom is fully healthy and that it's, you know, something that they can keep an eye on to make sure it doesn't regress and go back in the wrong direction, assuming what they're saying is true right now. But yeah, you undermine your own credibility when you presumably withhold any details about the situation and then, you know, say, oh, yeah, that's what happened, but it's over. Just a weird update, but I don't think, unless the Mets make the playoffs and everything goes 100% perfect for DeGrom, maybe starting to throw more, ramping things up. Again, I don't think we would see him pitch in the regular season this year, but I just hope that it's just a weird thing and we get to watch him at the beginning of next year on a regular basis, because man, is it fun to do that.
Yeah, and you know, if there was a partial tear, and I know the sprain is like the lowest grade tear you can have, I would almost rather just shut him down now.
Yeah.
Just let him have a nice long off season to heal up, and we'll see what happens next year.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, what is your music pick for this week?
Well, for the first time in a very long time, went to a show last night, and no disrespect to any of the music that we've seen at, you know, outdoors at breweries or maybe elsewhere over the course of this summer, but this was our first show, you know, like first ticketed event to actually have to buy, you know, buy a ticket to and go into and all that. And that's something that used to happen, I don't know, 30 to 50 times a year on it, you know, in a normal year. So it was pretty significant. And the band Meat Bodies, they're a band I had not seen. It's kind of funny. Not that I thought they were like the biggest band in the world, but I guess just because of their associations with Ty Segall and Fuzz and just being part of that world, you know, the fact that they were playing Knitting Factory in Brooklyn was kind of like, oh, okay, this is cool. You know, this is a like relatively small venue. Nice way to kind of dip the toes back in the water on live music. And they just so happened to put out a new record called 333 on Friday. So, yeah, I've only gotten to actually listen to the album a couple times. Obviously, they played some songs from it at the show. I don't know where it'll rank once I get to know it more and compare it to their first two records. But I do know that it's worth an album rec. Coming off an actual live show. So yeah, Meat Bodies 333, just came out on Friday, and yeah, that's my rec. The songs that they did play from it in person, you know, they were good. So
this is one of the few times where I can say I saw that band before Chris did. I saw them at the 2015 Four Knots Festival, which is an outdoor show they did at was it South Street Seaport? Or it was one of the
yeah, I think that's where those all were when they changed the name.
Yeah, no, this was a Pier 84. I'm just looking it up now, but you know, close enough. The lineup was let's see, it's when you go from the top, it starts to be like, oh, that's pretty stacked. But the bottom, like, Surfboard, Heaven, Heaters, Happiness. Those bands I'm vaguely familiar with, but I don't remember many of their sets. But Meat Bodies, Screaming Females, Michael Cronin, Twin Peaks, Stephen Malkmus, and Super Furry Animals were the other bands that day. I remember Meat Bodies being excellent that day. But again, that was now 6 years ago, so I'm sure they are a different band live now because time is terrible. But it's funny, I had picked my music pick this afternoon before talking with you, before knowing what you were going to pick, and it has a connection to this show I saw Meat Bodies at. My pick is the final album by Pavement, Terror Twilight. Pavement's lead singer, Stephen Malkmus, played the Four Knots Festival. So for a while, Matador Records was doing this great reissue series with Pavement, where they reissued their first four records with, I mean, like an extra disc or two of bonus material, radio sessions, B-sides, demos, live stuff, just really fantastic. Each of these reissues was better than the last, and I was getting really hyped because my favorite Pavement record, I'm the only guy on the planet who feels this way, I think, my favorite Pavement record is their last one, Terror Twilight, and they never did a reissue for it. And it really, really bothered me. But apparently, they are doing a reissue of it that comes out. I don't think there's been an official release date for it yet, but it's supposed to be coming out either like late this year or early next year. And it's Pavement is doing a UK/ European tour next year. They did a reunion tour here in 2010 or 2011 that I saw one of the shows, and I guess they didn't play a lot of European shows outside of festivals. So they're doing a European tour late this year, and the sort of the image on the tour poster looks a lot like the Terror Twilight album art. So I'm hoping that this album reissue comes out. But the album was produced by Nigel Godrich, who did all of the Radiohead records, and the band has somewhat mixed feelings on it. Lead singer Malkmus does not like it. He says it's kind of a halfway album. They didn't go full enough in either direction on it, whereas guitarist Scott Canberg, Spiral Stairs, calls it his second favorite Pavement record. It is by far my favorite Pavement record. I think Godrich is just such a good producer. The band has never like sonically sounded better. The songs are a little bit tighter, but there's also a lot of cool, interesting, weird jamming on it. I know Chris will not listen to this album because Chris does not like Stephen Malkmus's voice, and that is totally a fair assessment of his voice. I happen to like his voice, but I could totally understand why somebody wouldn't. But this one really, really is a special album to me, and it's one of those albums that whenever I meet someone else who likes it, it's like a secret handshake because no one likes his Pavement album. So it's fun to have those sort of records that seems like a little subsect within a band's fandom. So that's how I feel about Terror Twilight. So that is my pick in anticipation of the reissue, hopefully later this year, early next year.
Nice. Now my follow-up question to all that is, did Matador call the previous series of reissues, did they call it Repavement?
They did not, no.
They should have.
Each one had like a had a title that was based on like either a B-side or something. So like I know that the alternate title they were considering for Terror Twilight was Farewell Horizontal. So apparently this one's going to be called Terror Twilight, the Farewell Horizontal Edition. Or like when they did their Bright in the Corners record, they called it the Nicene Credence Edition. And I don't know what all those titles mean, but they're all kind of cutesy titles. So, but Repavement would be a very good name for the series. Missed opportunity for sure for Matador Records. at least if you're a fan of pun-based humor, as I clearly am. So anyway, thank you all for listening. We appreciate it. Go to AmazingAvenue.com. We have lots about the Mets every day going up as the season winds down. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You find this podcast on Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon, Apple. Wherever you find podcasts, you'll find us. Please rate, review, and subscribe. We appreciate it. Chris is on Twitter at Chris McShane. I am on Twitter at Brian Itzenap. And until next time, let's go Mets.